This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Meg Lauman travels all over the world conducting canopy research. Turns out a whole universe lives at the top of trees. Creatures up there can live an entire life without ever touching the ground. Lauman's work is in the field, and it so impressed National Geographic that they called her a real-life Lorax, the Dr. Seuss character who spoke for the trees against the greedy Wunsler. She came out of the forest long enough to be the director of North Carolina's new Nature Research Center. There she oversees all aspects of its cutting-edge technology center, including staff supervision, research lab funding, strategic planning, all that good stuff. Meg Lauman has a new guidebook out called Methods in Forest Canopy Research, and she's a research professor in physical and mathematical sciences at North Carolina State University and joins us now. Meg, welcome to State of Things. So great to have you here.
Oh, what an honor. It's really wonderful to be here.
Great. So much of your life has been involved in canopy research, and now that you're doing some indoor work, I just wonder how you have time, and do you, to travel and continue your research in the trees?
It keeps me busy, and there's no time to sleep. Of course, forest conservation is a really busy field, but I think the Nature Research Center and so much that's going on here in North Carolina is worth coming out of the trees. It's a fantastic national and international model, and I think my real passion is helping the next generation get inspired about science. So what a great thing to do, being part of this team.
You know, I wondered about that because it's so exciting. I mean, for anybody who has not seen Meg on National Geographic or, you know, go up to YouTube and just type in the name and you'll see her up in the trees doing all this great work. Very exciting. But then I think, well, yeah, if you can come down and be in a museum where people are seeing the fruit of your work, that may in many ways inform what you do when you get back to the trees. Am I right?
I think it does. And I think in a lot of ways right now we're learning as scientists that the most important part of the whole process is communication to the public. We've missed the boat in a couple cases, and people are really aware that what better combination than a public museum with over 1 million visitors and really cool scientists doing important things that maybe can change the planet.
Now, tell us what got you interested in climbing trees and what made you think that would be a fun thing for a lady from Elmira, New York to do.
Maybe that's why there wasn't a whole lot to do in Elmira, New York. No movie theater. I'm embarrassed to admit, 2 black and white TV stations. But, you know, I made little tree forts with my best friend, Betsy Hilfiger, and we laugh about that. We tried to rescue birds that fell out of the trees. We tried to Band-Aid earthworms back together that got cut in the lawnmowers and blah, blah, blah. You know, it was just kind of a passion. And the funny part about that story is she was my next door neighbor. Her brother's this weird guy named Tommy Hilfiger. He was in the basement of their house sewing bell bottom jeans.
Wow.
And would never play outdoors with us. So it just shows you should follow your passion, I guess.
Wow, I didn't know that. So does he ever like make clothes for you when you climb the trees?
We laugh about that. He has a khaki line out now, and we actually have both sponsored together a program in the summer in Elmira for underserved high school girls to do science. So I know that he's really interested, and we both laugh about how our careers went their different ways.
It's pretty interesting. What about it? I mean, does it take a certain amount of agility? Were you able to take to the trees quickly? Do you have to learn how to do that, strap up, get up and down safely and all that?
I guess I'm not one of those dedicated athletic types, but I will say that I was driven by the questions when I first climbed a tree because I wanted to figure out how long a leaf lived in a tropical rainforest. I got up there and it was buzzing with things flying around me and, you know, singing and shrieking and pollinating. And so I thought, holy cow, I had no idea, nor did anyone else in the world for that matter, that there was this amazing eighth continent on Earth, as we call it. So it was just at that point, I couldn't look back or down or whatever it took. So I really had to become an arbornaut. That's what we call tree researchers. Instead of astronaut, we're up a tree.
So you got agile fast because that's
I did. Yeah. And there's great hardware. It doesn't really require any superheroism. I actually have a grant this summer to take mobility limited students into the canopy. They can actually be hoisted up a tree without any kind of great sports, you know, manship. So it's good to know.
in your book, Life in the Treetops, you talk at length about the challenges of balancing your life, not so much as a museum director then, but as a mom and somebody who's going to spend a lot of time in the rainforest.
Right. And I feel pretty strongly about that as a woman in science, especially in my field where there aren't too many women. I hope that my book, which I sometimes refer to as my misadventures, can be some sort of way of educating other women about juggling career and family. It's a really important issue for both men and women, and I think it's not discussed very openly in the world of science, where people tend to think they should devote 24 hours a day to their research. But let's face it, in my case, I think it inspired me a lot. I think my kids' perspective and their sense of wonder really helped me direct my science more creatively.
Yeah, and it's interesting and inspiring that you do that. And it's a little sad that we only talk about it in terms of women having to balance that. And we never even think to say that men should have a balancing question to ask themselves as well.
That's true. And, you know, when I first, well, I was a single mom for quite a while, so I took my kids to the field a lot, and a lot of my male colleagues were so critical. And then a couple of years later, they would email or call me and say, oh, by the way, I really want to take my child to the rainforest. Now, what did you pack in your suitcase or how did you manage? And so I think it's now become a lot more popular.
I'm curious about their criticism. What was it? It's too dangerous? You're taking them out of school? What was it?
I think, you know, in the 90s and the late 1980s, we were looking at that last chapter of, I hate to say it, but the male bastion of being in the tropical field, wrestling anacondas, you know, putting up with hot flies digging under your skin. So there was that sense that this would not be a place for children.
Edward and James are your children, and they did essentially grow up in the rainforest. How do you think this has affected them?
Poor guys. They know how to eat bugs. They're good tree
actually
climbers.
You learn that on your own, I
That's
think, early
true.
On. But so
you know, we laugh, and of course they thought their mom was the weirdest person on the planet. But I do think in retrospect that being in remote places and being away from technology with your family is a very special experience, because you share the five senses, you share Mother Nature, and those are good things for families to do. So now I really advocate that. I take groups to the Amazon in the summer, and a lot of times families ask to come and help me with my research, in part because they want to bond with their kids.
Wow. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, well, apart from all of the other rules where everybody else is enforcing some part of the rule structure for you, it's all about you and that relationship. Now, were there times where you were concerned about safety? Was it dangerous?
Always. I think I was sleepless more about the kids than I might have been about the research. But there were those times. One day I actually climbed and left them on the forest floor in Belize, and I came down and they proudly had collected 100 army ants in a little vial with forceps. And of course, those ants bite like crazy. And there was always the snake issue. And we had some times with tarantulas falling off of the ceiling into the beds, but I was lucky in a way, I guess, because they were close in age. They had each other for companionship and maybe for sharing the tarantula joy.
Right. Great stories now. If you survive them, they're terrific stories
when you
finally get it. So in your second book, It's a Jungle Up There, you write that there was a favorable New York Times review for Life in the Treetops, and there was a eureka moment for you. Tell us about that.
It was amazing. You know, I wrote this public book called Life in the Treetops only because Yale University Press contacted me and they said a woman had never written a book about the tropics. Would you do that? Because maybe your perspective on the research and the ability to carry on as a woman in science would be different from a male. And I thought, holy cow, I have to write this book. But I never had intended to write a memoir type of book until I was 80 or something. So ahead I went and wrote it. And in doing that and kind of really stressing out about the time it took to write a book, when I did get this amazing review from some person in the New York Times Book Review that I'll never know, it really propelled the book into the hands of policymakers and housewives and people that would have never otherwise cared about tropical rainforests. So it taught me a life lesson, and that was I should give a certain part of my time as a scientist to public science communication. And I think that's what changed me in terms of the portfolio of my work outreach. And I think it also is what inspires me to really love this program at the Nature Research Center, because it's probably the way that science needs to move, and it might make a difference.
Is this move toward public scholarship, which I think we're seeing all throughout the academy in various disciplines, is it having an effect on the way scholars communicate with each other? And if so, for the better or for the worse?
I think so. I think scientists are now developing two languages, which is fun to watch. And the next generation will be the real experts in this sort of two-sidedness. But there's the public language, and then there's still the technical language that's used in conferences and publications that are peer-reviewed. So hopefully students will get training at university level in how to relate to both audiences. And then I think we really will be on the right track.
On the State of Things today, talking to Meg Laumann, head of the Nature Research Center at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. More of that conversation just ahead on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. It is Science Week on the State of Things. Today, talking to Dr. Meg Laumann, director of the Nature Research Center and national spokesperson for biodiversity and conservation. I want to ask you about that, because I noticed that in your research, one of the things I had never considered was how careful you are about conserving even the leaves that you're having to do experiments on. So taking with you synthetic leaf extract so that you're not disturbing this abundant rainforest. So a lot of care and attention goes into just designing the experiment, I guess, huh?
It is true. And I think with forest canopies, because it's a new area of exploration, we've had to design everything from scratch. That was what my recent book is all about, trying to give the recipes, so to speak, for students of the future. But truly, with this canopy region, with its millions of species, many of which are never, you know, classified or known at this point in time, maybe there's the cure for cancer. It sounds like a cliche, but we've seen this happen over and over, where fantastic things come out of unknown regions of the planet. And so I would not want to squish the only one.
Right. Well, talk about biodiversity, because clearly there's a great concern that we're losing rainforest far too quickly. I mean, give us the scope. How do you see, where are we today?
Sure. And forest conservation is a little depressing right now. We have lost over half of the forests on the planet. We replant plantations and other kinds of things, but we don't often get the composition of the original forest and all those little critters that might have lived in the treetops originally. So right now it's a critical time. Scientists, we estimate, have only identified and classified about 2% of the biodiversity on the planet. So we don't really know what we've lost. And I think that's the real frustration. It's one thing to understand everything in a system and know exactly all the parts, for example, your car or your air conditioner. But we all know that if you lost half of the hardware in your car and you expected it to drive, you might be in big trouble. And that's what's going on with forests.
It's a real challenge, it seems to me, to have the responsibility that you've taken on to try to talk about biodiversity and the importance to all of us. Because for those of us who have not been in the treetops and seen all of this amazing diversity that we'll never see anywhere else, it's hard for us to get our head around the fact that it matters, that little beetle that will never touch the ground up in a treetop in a place thousands of miles from me matters to me today, here and now.
Right. I think you're so right, Frank, and it is hard to convey that. I hope and think that as children get better science education in school, as we foster an understanding, even if it's an app on their iPhone, if it's a video, let's face it, there are a lot of new tools out there that don't replace nature, but they might enhance nature. We need to give kids a sense of the complexity of these systems. It's extraordinary. Our lives depend on them. I just got back from Ethiopia, where less than 5% of the forests are left, but they contain the fresh water, the medicines, the pollinators of all their crops. So, you know, bingo, it adds up to this really, really expensive toolkit of what's keeping human beings alive.
And they're amazing. They're amazing engines. They move a lot of water. They move a lot of gas in and out. I mean, if you think about what one tree accomplishes in the course of a lifetime, it's a great story.
And that technically we call that ecosystem System Services. And guess what? They do it while you sleep. That's about the most wonderful machine in the world. We just have to leave it alone a little tiny bit.
Alex Sink, who is Florida's chief financial officer, appointed you as science advisor on climate change. Did the state legislature make any changes as a result of your finding?
Right. In my last world, which was living in Florida as a professor and a botanical garden director, it was a great experience to work with a Republican cabinet for the most part. We did implement a lot of new changes. We had the first ever task force to look at adaptation for Florida with its amazing coastline. We implemented, thanks to the governor, a $25 million program to map all the coastlines. And we had quite a network of leadership. We had a Leadership Florida group. We had a whole cadre of mayors and bank presidents and other people, insurance agents, of course, that were really interested in the outcomes. Now, Florida's a conservative state. It's not as if things were changing by the day, but I think we made some big inroads. Arnold Schwarzenegger came and launched one of the first big national climate change conferences with a lot of international visitors. And I will say that both Jeb Bush and Charlie Crist were very interested and concerned for the fate of that state.
Is climate change affecting biodiversity in the rainforest? Does it have an impact?
Absolutely.
There?
And, you know, climate change, call it what you will, these more stressful environmental conditions that we're seeing, more significant storms or extreme droughts and heavy rains on the other side of the earth, are definitely stressing organisms that are used to a certain range of temperature and moisture. And we do see examples both in the states as well as in the tropics about species shifting ranges. We have a lot of cases in Australia, for example, where animals are moving up hillsides in the tropics of Queensland, but now they've reached the top of the hill. So where will they go next? And I think that's the big next chapter for biodiversity research. What to do with these creatures that are shifting? Will human beings go in and carry them by carloads to, you know, different sites? It would become too expensive, of course, to do that.
Well, the answer is, I mean, it seems to me there are sort of two avenues of resistance against doing anything about climate change. And one is the absolute denial of it. We'll just set that aside for a moment. The other is, look, this is nature too. And humans are natural beasts. And like other natural creatures, they have changed their environment. And let it go. If you're really a conservative, let nature, if you want to conserve, don't get in the way of that. And let humans then, I guess, fix it or create a world in which we can live with this new climate. What about that argument?
I think that biodiversity and all of conservation actually combines both economics and science. We can't overlook the fact that a lot of these things cost money, and so we have to look really ruthlessly and carefully. And even though pure scientific fact might say, oh, let's save everything, let's do everything exactly right, we just know that reality speaks. A case in point are the Burmese pythons in Florida. Now, should we let 100,000 pythons slither around the Everglades and affect tourism, or is that a good species to try to alter? On the other hand, you might have an invasive weed that could grow on the side of the highway, and people have to accept the fact that it would be too expensive to eradicate it. So we're coming to a point where I think both policymakers and scientists need to be in the room together talking about the cost of solutions and try to keep the best quality of life we can.
But it really leads to the question, have we gone so far in controlling our environment that we really now are in charge, that we can't just let it all go? We're really going to have to now technically keep ourselves alive through our own, basically through our own means.
I think our behavior indicates that we are doing that, becoming God. And of course, I think the one good thing about human beings is ethics. We don't want to sit by and watch people starve to death simply because we've created a little bit of, you know, alteration of the climate over there in Africa. We don't really like to see floods affecting the coastlines of New Jersey and New York. So what will we do? It is a huge question, and it will take a lot of vision in both science, I think, and economics and politics. A really unprecedented trio of things sitting together at the table.
You talked about being in Ethiopia recently. What kind of work are you doing there? What brought you to Ethiopia?
I guess as a forest conservation biologist, I get called out sometimes because there aren't so many of us to go around, and Ethiopia is what I would call an urgent or SOS situation. Again, I mentioned less than 5% of the forests remain in northern Ethiopia. Believe it or not, those little green patches are in the churchyards. And so my project there puts me in partnership with the Coptic priests. I just led a workshop for the 100 church leaders of northern Ethiopia. Actually, 150 showed up, and we talked about how they need to ascertain the boundaries of their church, save them because of the fresh water in the forests that surround the church, save the forest because of the biodiversity and the pollinators. So we basically created a grassroots scheme and solution where we're going to be building stone walls around these remaining forests. Pretty exciting because it's an example of one country where we could implement a positive solution, but it's not as easy in the Amazon, for example, or Indonesia, where there's so many more complexities.
Why does anybody in a place like Ethiopia consider that a priority when you go in there and you have a success that you just described? What is it about the appeal that you make that makes them think this and not some other priorities is what we need to focus on?
In the case of Ethiopia, funny you should ask, it actually is because religion views its, you know, stewardship of all of God's creatures is very important, and so do scientists. So for once in my life, I'm working with a group of people that really have the same mission. And this is a unique case, I think, of how diverse stakeholders are coming together. I think the same thing is happening in America, where sometimes conservation looks to religion. Sometimes conservation looks to farmers, groups that we don't typically associate in common may be the solution ultimately.
When you do your research, when you're up in the trees, what's the biggest charge for you? I mean, is it finding a species that had been not identified before, or is it, I mean, what is it that is the big charge for you?
I guess I'm a kid at heart. Climbing a tree is pretty fun. Let's be honest about that. I'm sure astronauts say the same thing about going into space. But initially, in my technical research past, discovering those new species and understanding what they did in that complex environment was really important. Now I think the aspect of climbing and the adventure of canopy research is really useful as far as inspiring kids and inspiring policymakers or diverse people to think harder about how a forest is this amazing place. You know, historically, we only saw the first 6 feet of a forest. We walked on the forest floor and never knew what 95% of this whole place was doing. And now we have a much better understanding for this whole, as you called it, machine that really does keep us healthy.
We're seeing a lot more attention paid to something that I think is commonly known as backyard science these days. The idea that in our backyards and perhaps, you know, in our bathrooms, we have little creatures living that we hadn't discovered before. A lot more attention being paid to that right here. I mean, are you excited about that? The fact that people are looking in their backyards and saying, look at this thing. I don't know if we have a name for this yet.
Totally. I'm really excited about that. And that's one arena where the Nature Research Center hopes to become a national leader. We call it citizen science in the trade. I love the word backyard. And we have some amazing scientists at the NRC doing new projects. We have one to look at the arthropods that live in your home. And they've discovered on the average 100 species of insects live in your home, regardless of how many times you clean it a week. So get ready. And, you know, we have other groups looking at the ants in schoolyards, which is really cool. And now we have our genetics lab looking at the biodiversity of your armpit. So watch out.
Talk about balancing the priorities of a mom and a scientist. That's really rough work, isn't it? I'm excited about this bug. Now let's kill it because it's in my toilet. Listen, and getting back to your roots and how you got interested in this, you won second prize in the New York State Science Fair when you were in fifth grade, only second prize.
Oh,
and here you
gosh.
Are at the top of your profession. But second prize, you were, let's see, fifth grade. Do you remember the project?
I do. I was such a geek, first of all. I still am, I guess. But I was so shy, too. I never would have dared talk on this radio show with you until many older years of my life. But I had a wildflower collection. I pressed wildflowers in all the old phone books that my parents let me collect and had this vast collection of flowers that lived in upstate New York and dutifully took this to the science fair, surrounded by, I think, 499 boys with their rockets and electricity projects. And there I was, and it was amazing that I even did get second prize. My dad ran out of gas actually driving me to Cortland, New York, so we were lucky to get there.
A little chemistry experiment there. How much gasoline do we need? What about the question of women in science? I think generally speaking, we hear things are getting better for women, but where are we today, and do we need to work harder to encourage more women or stop discouraging them if that's the case?
Right. I still think we have what I call an invisible glass ceiling. There are a lot more opportunities for women. There are great statistics of women graduating with PhDs in certain fields, but not all. We still have these cracks, though. Women are not assuming leadership positions. Women on average in science are making 2/3 of what men earn in the same positions. And the tenure process in universities isn't really kind to women who may have a biological clock ticking. So I think a lot of what is starting to happen is networking and becoming role models for women. I have a group of women students from Duke that we meet once a month and go to a pub just like the guys and talk about things like negotiating, grant writing, juggling family and science. I have quite a few women scientists at the NRC, which is exciting to see, and we do the same kind of thing. We try to make sure that we're communicating to each other those kinds of issues that maybe are holding women back. And as we move forward, it will take role models for the next generation to have equity in different careers, I think.
How about at the elementary and secondary levels? Are there things happening there that in some ways redirect women or discourage young girls from having a career in science?
The data from National Science Foundation and the National Academy of Sciences still indicates that a lot of times girls are directed out of those hard scientists. They certainly don't pick up on the video games as much. They don't tend to excel in those advanced math classes or take an interest in them as much as boys do, and definitely not with physics and engineering. So there is, again, I think, a subtle example of where maybe they need more role models and maybe they need to see women in science. I edit and review a lot of biology textbooks, and oftentimes there are hardly any women case studies. For scientists, there are mostly still men as the chapter examples.
Hmm. Well, I wonder if this is a problem of language. I mean, math is a language. It's one that at the moment men seem to have some kind of advantage in terms of numbers. Is it just a different way of telling the story? Can you do the research, come up with a way of narrating what we've discovered in a way that's provable and, you know, has all of the rigor of science? Do we need a different language? Do we need a different way to tell our story?
I think that math is a beautiful language. It's elegant. It is relatively logical. I think women have every bit is good an opportunity to do that. And let's face it, there are so many aspects of life that require math. Both men and women need to balance checkbooks
and look
at models. Probably climate change would benefit if a lot of us had more math in school. And part of it is probably just making sure that we have really well-trained, enthusiastic teachers, maybe rewarding teachers more that are excellent in their field. Certainly, that's a big agenda in America right now, the quality of STEM education and how we can ensure global competitiveness for the future.
And look for those subtle ways in which women perhaps are being discouraged and men are being encouraged that the teachers themselves, the schools themselves, are not aware of. Certainly, they wouldn't like to know that this is happening, but they might want to find out how these settle. So what was your biggest surprise up in the trees?
Oh, gosh.
Apart from getting down alive, I suppose.
I guess my biggest surprise really was, as I suppose a pioneer in this field, that discovery that so many things lived up there. I certainly assume that all these crusty old foresters who'd been, you know, exploring and maybe mostly cutting down all of our beautiful forests for so many generations knew everything about trees. And I was just going to add a little tiny data point somewhere there. But to get to the top of a tree in the rainforest and find out that not only thousands of things, but millions of things had never been documented was pretty extraordinary and also daunting.
Meg, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was really great.
Meg Lauman, director of the Nature Research Center at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. For more information, go to canopymeg.com. Coming up, what chimps can tell us about the way we socialize. Stay tuned to the State of Things.